coming up on Path to Zero.
Infrastructure involves a lot of what we call in the industry debottlenecking, where you can build pretty simple infrastructure and really help reduce both the cost, but also the volatility of pricing.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
As the energy system grows more complex, there's a renewed focus on infrastructure, reliability, and the policies that support them. John DeBar, Executive Director of the National Petroleum Council, brings decades of experience across the energy value chain and now helps advise the U.S. Department of Energy on these critical issues. John, it is so great to have you today on Path to Zero, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
I'm looking forward to this conversation a long time, and we have so many different ways we can talk about it, but let's just start talking about you and your job. You're leading the National Petroleum Council, which really gives a lot of input into DOE. Tell us more maybe about the role that I'll just call National Petroleum Council, NPC, from here on out. But tell us about that role that you play in shaping energy policy, maybe both in the U.S. or even abroad.
So National Petroleum Council is a federal advisory committee to the Department of Energy. We have about 185 members, all appointed by the secretary for a two-year term. About half of those members come from the oil and gas sector and from many different parts of the sector, upstream, midstream, downstream, local gas companies, service companies, drillers, LNG companies. The other half of our members are people that are really experts in energy, but in many different areas. So we have academics, investment bankers, state regulators. We always have one state PUC chair. Mr. DeFrank from Pennsylvania is currently a member. We have tribal organizations that have an oil and gas interest, like the Osage Nation and the Inupiat in Alaska. We have think tanks. Some of the DC think tanks are involved, like Brookings and Clearpath. And we have environmental organizations like the Environmental Defense Fund and Rocky Mountain Institute. So what we bring to the table is this really wide aperture of evaluation, things that are not good for a particular company or things that are good for a particular sector of the industry, but what's really good for the country and for the American people.
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about that because that's a subject near and dear to my heart. But that's, you know, you were at CERAWeek, and I know you were busy that whole week, but you gave a really important talk there about the evolving energy narrative. So give us the highlights of that talk, but maybe even more importantly, what do you think is missing or perhaps even misunderstood in the energy narrative today?
So one of the key points of work that we've done is around permitting, which usually that's when people decide to check their phones or go get a cup of coffee, because permitting doesn't sound like an exciting subject. And honestly, it shouldn't be. It should be a pretty meticulous process where the project proponent says, this is what we propose to do. Here are the alternatives. They follow the law and the regulations. They engage with the community, and then they deliver energy infrastructure in particular. That helps people get more affordable, more reliable energy. That sounds pretty straightforward. And one of the things that we've really recommended is that regulators follow what's in the law by having a certain amount of public outreach, a certain amount of permitting process, but really, you know, addressing what the law is trying to solve. And so, for example, people are pretty passionate about water and clean water, whether it's for drinking or sportsmen or agriculture. Water is an important subject. We've recommended that state regulators follow the letter of the law with respect to the Clean Water Act and say, if I'm going to evaluate a permit for a pipeline to cross a river, and you have to cross rivers, they're all over the country, that the regulators say, how does this permit affect the water quality at this location? You know, very much focusing on the intent of the project and what it delivers. I will say the other area, and I mentioned it briefly, Tucker, is community engagement. A big part of what project proponents do, and this is whether it's oil and gas or electric transmission lines, it applies to either one, is to engage with the community where that project is going to be built and make sure that they have a voice and make sure that their concerns are addressed up front. And if a better solution can come about that addresses that community's needs, that's great. That's really the goal of it. So those are probably the two big things that are misunderstood, community engagement and sort of what is required to get a permit.
Yeah, I don't think most people follow how difficult it is to permit most anything. I mean, really, and community engagement is so important. How do you think government, I'll just use it, it could be state, local, it can be federal, they manage that community engagement when almost always there's a pushback for having something built, right? It's almost always not in my backyard. I wonder today if we could rebuild the interstate system. Certainly, I don't think we could build the pipeline network that we built, you know, early on in to World War II. How do you think, what is the role of government and responsible agencies to balance the need of people who want nothing in their backyard and the need for a nation to actually grow in infrastructure? And it doesn't really matter whether it, I love to talk about a 3D infrastructure, stuff that's below the ground, pipes that are so valuable, things that are above the ground, electric wires, and things that are on the ground, like highways, railroads, trains, that kind of thing.
Well, one of the things I've learned, and I'll quote one of my Native American members from the Southern Ute tribe, when you know one tribe's needs, you know one tribe's needs. It's not directly transferable to others. And the same thing with communities. I'll quote one of the people I worked with in South Texas, the head of the local school board, who said to me, "John, we don't mind fracking, but what we really don't like are the fracking trucks driving through the school zone at 7:30 in the morning." I said, "Okay, now that's something I can work with. We can address your needs." Another community member that I dealt with in South Louisiana said, "You know, we see a lot of out-of-state license plates from people coming to work here. How come you're not training our high school kids so that they can get jobs working at your facility?" I said, "Great, that's something that we can work with. Work with the local Votech school or the local community college to say, here's the skills we need. Here's what training they need, and then they can apply for jobs locally rather than importing skill sets from out of town." Those are also the kind of things that help communities say, okay, there's something in it for me other than a faceless corporation coming in and doing work in my community. So that's the sort of the practical aspects of community engagement.
And I know you serve a variety of interests. Some of them are, you know, highly pro-business. Some of them perhaps are a little bit more environmentally minded. Who in this conversation is really advocating for, I don't know, we'll call it gross domestic product or advancement? Who do you have people in your organization that are really, because again, I think if you're going to advance and generally you're going to bill, I mean, it's almost always a trade-off, right? I'm trading off GDP for something that's probably not great. Who in your organization is advocating for, I guess, the nation or for the economy?
So the way that we advocate for that is by focusing on reliable and affordable energy. And, you know, that follows into improved economic performance for people and for companies. I would say all of the public sector CEOs that are members are, you know, clearly aligned with that. But it's really kind of a consensus across the entire council membership, whether somebody is an academic or a state regulator or a think tank. You know, they all see that there's an economic benefit from having energy delivered to people, having it be affordable and reliable, and minimizing the environmental impact of getting that energy from its source to the end user. So it's pretty much a consensus across our membership. The subtleties around, you know, what we put in our advice are, you know, always germane to whatever the subject is. If it's water treatment or pipeline construction or electric generation or natural gas drilling. So it's going to be specific, but I'd say all the members buy into that concept.
Yeah, it's a great answer. Thank you. The other, I've studied a lot of the work you've done, kind of, because I feel like you're in the center of one of the big debates right now, which is about data centers. But really, data centers for me are just a proxy for growing electrification. And before we even talk about that, one of the issues that I find so relevant, we seem to just fill up the narrative every day with electrification. But if you really think about total energy consumption, electrification isn't even the primary energy consumer, right? We still directly use natural gas, gasoline, diesel fuel, propane to power boilers and engines. And I mean, it's, how do you think about not only today's energy, but maybe let's go forward a decade or two, the evolving energy narrative in terms of direct use, which I'd argue is always perhaps the most efficient, and indirect use with areas like electrification. How do you balance that conversation among your constituents?
Well, the first is we use the U.S. Energy Information Industry Association model. It's called the National Energy Modeling System. And that's what we use to model what the different changes might be in energy end use and energy source based on different parameters. So that way it's taking an integrated model of saying, if you have the price of natural gas goes up, that correlates closely to the price of electricity. That might either reduce the consumption of electricity or encourage people to switch to a different source of electricity. That's one example. So the correlation between these different energy modes and their conversion is a really important part of the study that work that we do. And we've got a big piece of work going on right now, which will likely get finished end of this year, on integrating the oil vertical, which includes transportation fuels like diesel and jet fuel, the natural gas vertical, which includes end-use heating, industrial use, and electric power generation, and the electricity industry, which to some extent has electrical generation not from oil and gas, that's nuclear and renewables, but also has an end-use delivery that in some cases is an alternative to using natural gas for end-use heating or other consumption. So really looking at that integrated model and looking at the trade-offs that if the supply of this goes up, the price might go down, and people might switch over time from one energy source to another. That's really how we look at the problem.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I know. I see the data quite regularly, and I'm always shocked if you think about total terawatts of energy consumed, how little is really generated in electricity. And obviously, that'll be growing over time. But it is interesting to me that still the story around energy is very much the energy that's consumed directly for heating hot water, to power vehicles. And that it's an evolving story. Well, you're in the middle of the debate around data centers and what all that means. This has been an interesting week, as I believe one state now is beginning to say, we're going to take a pause on data centers. See, I've seen this week, a couple data centers individually, their permits either rejected or delayed. Tell us how you see this plays out over the next 5 or 6 years. Do you think, and actually this was a week where I think I saw the data that said for maybe the first time, we actually had more computing demand than we had ability to supply on a minute by minute basis. Clearly we're kind of short infrastructure. We're trying to build data centers that really don't have perhaps adequate water, adequate anything. And then the power grid to supply it is woefully short. How does that all play out, John?
Well, first, I have to say that the Department of Energy was pretty forward-looking on that, and we added 2 data center companies to the National Petroleum Council. So we actually have 2 pretty major players in that the data center industry providing input to our policy advice. So to try to address exactly the kind of things you're talking about, The second area is in the subject of generation of electricity and its source and how that gets connected to the grid. That's a piece of work that we're looking into right now, how much the distributional effects of where generation is connected and where a large load are connected and how much of the grid it is using and how the cost of that grid in, capacity increase gets allocated between that source consumer pair versus sort of the general population. That's a real challenge for public utility commissioners, which is why we've got, a PUC member on the council, to say what is the right way to allocate those costs, and that the right way to protect consumers, but also make sure consumers' reliability doesn't get reduced. The second interesting part of that is we have got a number of the major data center power generation companies are members, including Caterpillar and GE Vernova are members of the council. So we're also able to get input on the generating side of things. How's that equipment put in place? Where does it best fit on the grid? How does it connect to the grid? So a part of our broad membership allows us to give a really broad remit on how do data center loads get connected to the grid? Where do they buy their power? How do they get the reliability that they want? And how are consumers' price and reliability protected in that area?
Yeah, of course, I live in Virginia, which has been the home of data centers mm-hmm. for a while. We're going to fight with Texas a little bit about who leads this next evolution. But clearly there's a movement around data centers impacting maybe reliability, certainly mm-hmm. data centers impacting the price of electricity, with some people saying it's going to reduce costs, some people saying it's going to increase costs, this whole move towards bring your own power. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you tend to see the evolution of data centers, which I believe is inevitable, and the evolution of the power grid to support data centers, do you tend mm-hmm. to think that it's going to be like many things, kind of all of the above? Or do you think there will be one method of supplying data centers that's kind of becomes the dominant method across the country?
Yeah, I don't think there's a single model that works every place for everybody. The first is, of course, different types of data centers do different things and have different load characteristics, whether it's an AI training data center versus an edge computing data center that's delivering streaming videos locally. So there's different needs of both reliability and energy stability that are needed at different types of data centers. While you can never underestimate the about of innovation in the oil and gas sector, the data center people are not standing still either. They're looking for ways to say, how do we reduce our impact? And one of the interesting things that we've learned at the council is that a lot of infrastructure for energy, both on electricity and in gas, are built for peak load. So if you say, well, here's my peak load, now you have to design everything for that peak load, even though it's only used for a few hours on a few days a year. So by optimizing that sort of what's called demand management, you can really kind of reduce that peak capital cost that's there only for those very, very few hours per year. The other thing that's interesting, and we're studying this right now, we'll be delivering something later this year, is the beneficial reuse of water that is produced from oil and gas. So fracking uses water, but it also produces a lot of salt water that comes up from underground that's already been there commingled with the oil. So you can clean that up. How can you use that for beneficial use, for example, cooling data centers rather than using, quote unquote, drinking water that you might have to purchase? So beneficial reuse of water for data centers is another area that partly helps them cite, this is where I can get water to cool my data center, and partly this is where water can be made available that you don't know of yet. So that's another interesting part of this is the water use question.
Yeah, interesting. And then I do want to address, because I think you have great insight into it, the oil and gas industry just kind of went through a period where it's fairly maligned. A lot of people saying the only path to a cleaner climate is going to be through electrification. And that electrification almost had to come from solar wind, which isn't probably the reality of life. But now we've seen a resurgence, largely thanks to Secretary Wright and kind of a changed dialogue. But we've seen the oil and gas industry pivot as well. One, I would argue, gas particularly is much lower in carbon than it was 50 years ago. But also see geothermal energy kind of evolving with techniques that come out of oil and gas, the ability for fewer oil and gas wells to produce larger volumes. How do you see that oil and gas industry evolving? Do you see them, I mean, is it bigger than fracking? Is it bigger than geologic hydrogen or geothermal? Is it, I mean, will oil and gas perhaps move into nuclear? How do you see oil and gas evolving?
Well, the beauty of the oil and gas industry is that you've got lots of companies, big and small, that are making individual decisions about where they want to deploy capital and where they want to apply technology. So there is no one size fits all of what the oil and gas industry will do. We've got members that have really big wind and solar businesses. We have members that don't do anything with wind and solar. We have members that are investors in major geothermal companies. We have members that don't care about it at all. And so what you'll see is a lot of people trying different things, applying different technologies, using the science that's available that comes out of the national laboratories. But I think that the ultimate metric there, and I'll quote 1970s environmentalist Amory Lovins, who said, people don't want to buy energy. They want hot showers and cold beer. And so what the oil and gas industry will continue to do is to find really good technology solutions and market solutions to deliver affordable, reliable, and secure energy to Americans and our allies.
Looking ahead, what are some of the more exciting or promising areas of study that you and your team are working on now?
So I mentioned briefly the produced water question. That's actually something we're doing a deep dive into right now. We actually started from the very beginning saying this needs to be both a technology question and a regulatory question. So we have two members from private sector oil, public sector oil and gas companies, and two members from state regulators that are working together on this study, and they're the leadership, the four-person leadership team. It's one thing to say, well, how clean can we make the water and how much does it cost to make it that clean? Great. There's lots of interesting technologies. Some are well proven in the field. Some are still in the laboratory. There's some great work going on at the national laboratories, at the Department of Energy on this subject. But the other one is the regulatory rules and how those are perceived by the public. And this is a place where really getting ahead of the concerns people will have. How do I know that this water is safe enough for my kids to swim in or for me to drink? I mean, how do I know that? You say that, how do I know that? And trust me isn't really a good approach on that. So a big part of the work that we're doing, and we're going to deliver it later this year, is how do you both get the technology right? Here's how you should clean up water for different applications, for agriculture, for watering livestock, for discharge into waterways. And how do you address the stakeholder concerns that they will be at least skeptical, if not opposed? And if you don't address those up front, they will be even more skeptical and even more opposed, no matter how much you say the technology is solving the problem.
A moment, I'm going to hand you a magic wand. This is a very important part of the podcast. With that magic wand, you get to choose one thing in the next year that you believe would have the most impact on the energy transition as you see it. John, how would you use that magic wand?
One of the interesting things we've learned is that infrastructure involves a lot of what we call in the industry debottlenecking, finding narrow points in the pipeline or electrical distribution and transmission system where you can build pretty simple infrastructure and really help reduce both the cost, but also the volatility of pricing. So my magic wand would be, let's really make it straightforward for companies to build incremental debottlenecking infrastructure often in places where there's already a facility, so that they can help deliver that energy to the people that already exist and as customers and know that they need it. So not every pipeline project needs to be a major green field built on untouched land. A lot of debottlenecking can really, really help reliability and consumer costs. So focusing on getting those kind of permitting reforms delivered.
Interesting. And do the companies, whether it's electric transmission or utility operators for pipelines, are they generally aware of those bottleneck locations and just haven't been able to address it? Or do we need a little bit more engineering to identify the bottlenecks?
Yeah, actually, the bottlenecks are very easy to identify. The gas pipeline people see it on their pressure charts to see where the pipeline pressure is dropping below what's acceptable for operation. And electricity markets, it's actually, in many cases, they have what's called locational marginal pricing. So not the price of electricity at this node. And if that price of electricity spikes up, it's usually because there's not enough being delivered to that node. So there's pretty transparent pricing signals that tell you that you're short electricity at a certain location, pressure profiles that tell you you're short of gas. Really well understood from the engineers.
Interesting. Thank you. I love to go back and listen to our guest's use of the magic wand and really over a year at some of the most interesting answers. And it really does give you great indication of maybe how we can evolve to a better, more reliable grid. Let me ask you, because I feel like you may have been in the center of this as well. The president took an unprecedented act that really, I think it's only happened maybe once or twice in the history of time. He waived the Jones Act, I think only for 60 days. Have you seen any tangible benefits from that waiver? Do you think energy flowed differently because the Jones Act was waived? I'm not sure I saw anything that suggested it did, but I'm curious from your perspective.
So, Tucker, I haven't looked into it during this current waiver period. Typically, the council doesn't really dig into sort of day in, day out transactional pricing questions like that or transactional supply demand. We did make recommendations during our last study round in 2022 that Jones Act waivers, seasonal Jones Act waivers for LNG would be a benefit to consumer cost and reliability. So it is something that we have recommended in the past, but I haven't looked at the data in the current 60-day round.
Yeah, clearly, as we think about the Northeast, particularly, I would argue the Northeast is starved for infrastructure, whether it's electric infrastructure, natural gas infrastructure, propane infrastructures. It's just starved for infrastructure. It would seem to me that a waiver of the Jones Act would at least be something that we could begin to think about moving some of the energy products out of the Houston area and into that energy star of Northeast without building more pipelines. I hadn't seen it either, but it'll be interesting to see how we debrief that activity. One other fun thing we love to do, we like to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of your time, the expertise you shared with us. John, is there a particular national forest that comes to mind for you?
Yes, Cleveland National Forest, which is in Southern California, kind of on the eastern edge of Orange County, and on the other side, it's Palm Springs. And I have very fond memories of Cleveland National Forest because when I was a bit younger and a bit more athletic, my friends and I would go mountain biking there. And whether it was the 100-degree summers or the occasional ice patch in the middle of the winter. Yep, there was ice in Southern California. The one thing I remember most is checking the chalkboard at the entrance to the Cleveland National Forest, last date of mountain lion sighting. And it was frequently the day before. So there you are in the middle of the highly populated area in Southern California, and you've got the wilds of mountain lions living in a national forest.
It's funny. I've not heard of that national forest, and now you're compelling me to go learn more about it as well. But our producer Russ Ray will enjoy planting a tree there in honor of your time today. Thank you. John, before we let you go, there's so much going on. Is there anything else you'd like to highlight or how our listeners could maybe learn more about the work of the National Petroleum Council or anything else you want to tell them?
So all of our work is public domain. It's all available on both on the Department of Energy website and on the npc.org website that I maintain. All of our studies are in there, all of our recommendations. And if there are listeners out there that would like to get more information about it, they can contact me through through npc.org and we can provide more information.
That is great. We are so hopeful for you and your work with the team that you lead. DOE is so relevant to everything that we're doing and almost what our listeners are thinking about. So really want to thank you for not only being on this podcast, but for your work in the energy transformation. So thank you for being with us today on Path to Zero.
Tucker, thank you for having me and thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.